Your name?
Lou Hasem.
Where are you from?
South Africa.
Give us a picture of what's going on in South Africa.
It's 15 years, I suppose, that I should, you know, put some sort of landmark in relation to the struggle for South Africa to be a free country, free of the apartheid. So 15 years on, South Africa is a country which is struggling for against, I suppose I should say, struggling for its freedom still, and that struggle will always be there. But the freedom parameters have obviously changed, because some of the bigger problems that emerge now for the country are certainly poverty. We have the highest, it's not even the highest, it's the biggest gap. It's not the highest or the lowest, but it's a gap between the highest and the lowest. The richest and the poorest is second in the world after Brazil. That's very worrying. So we have also a very high rate of unemployment, an economy which has traditionally relied on gold for its major sort of economic growth. That's driven it into, certainly one of the into a position where it's one of the stronger economies in Africa. But the poverty is seriously impeding the level of well-being for citizens of South Africa who may not have jobs, may not have houses, may not have any form of livelihood security, may not have even lights and electricity. And there, you know, that's absolute poverty. Those are people who are very, very poor, and there are a lot of them. So I think also one has to look at women's rights in the country and how we progressed on that. We have a very high rate of gender violence, and I think that the country is trying really hard. Feminists are trying to ensure that that the law is implemented. There are laws that have been introduced to try to deal with the kinds of issues that relate to, justice, discouraging any form of sexual harassment, assault, and violence taking place. The policing is also very important. So those are the kinds of, technical things that people may not think about when they think about South Africa, but surely where women are located and the streets and their homes are not safe and the shack settlements aren't safe, it's an issue we have to keep looking at.
Louise Hasten, we were discussing earlier, and you mentioned that unemployment may be at 35-40%. That is a shocking, disturbing number.
Officially, I think the figures are often cited are much more conservative. But certainly in the province where I come from, it's one of the poorer provinces. It's KwaZulu-Natal. It's estimated to be certainly closer, to 40% than 30%. And, we've just come out of the World Cup, and I think that's, for a lot of the people in the country, there was this expectation. FIFA World Cup, the soccer World Cup. And it was successfully hosted. But I think that the expectations around that, in terms of economic gains, were obviously quite disappointing. Simply at the level of who was going to gain. And, of course, those gains have largely filtered directly to foreign companies, FIFA itself, and the soccer, the soccer game, which is not a bad thing. However, there was an expectation that the urban poor, the largely unemployed, would stand to benefit through some of the economic activities that derived, that were taking place around the construction of stadiums and the feeding of people, the tourism, and so forth. And I think that there were also a lot of scams. You know, there's a lot of people, you know, saying you're going to benefit from the World Cup, pay so much money and you will, you know, get a R1,000 or something, which is our currency, and people subscribing to this and then finding that it's not true. And I think one of the things that if you're talking about unemployment, when the FIFA World Cup goes to Brazil, certainly it's been to South Africa, there were 8 host cities, that the host city agreements that are signed by FIFA by the local municipalities actually involved the moving of the urban poor, like street vendors, sometimes homeless people, being shifted further into the periphery, into the margins, and because people have no other livelihoods, you're basically actually pushing them into a worse situation. So that was a concern, and there was a campaign, a very lively campaign, which I was part of. It's called the World Class Cities for All campaign, started by StreetNet International, where I worked. StreetNet International organizes street vendor organizations. It's an alliance of street vendor organizations, but international. And the campaign launched in 2006 based on the experience of the Korean affiliates of StreetNet, who had literally been evicted and disappeared, as it were, off the streets. And so we realized that this situation of what happens to the urban poor and the beautification processes building up to the hosting of these games is a very big concern for the urban poor, whether it's, you know, going to be Commonwealth Games in India, that's happening there too, it's happening in India, or in Brazil, you'll see that people don't necessarily have anybody to speak on their to represent them. So the campaign was very important in the sense that it brought together a series of organizations, 20, 30 organizations in South Africa representing her homeless, shack dwellers, sex workers organizations, certainly as well, child, you know, street children, children's organizations, and street vendors organizations, and other members of the urban poor. And there were a very important series of formally constituted meetings to negotiate with the host cities that there should be no forced removal of the street vendors without there being alternatives, which is a very basic demand, and it certainly falls within the South African constitutional rights that people have. And in Cape Town, for example, I can say that the mayor came to the launch of the campaign and congratulated the street vendors, and on the same day announced that the square where they are actually working was going to be taken over by FIFA for hosting what, you know, they would be doing, which is the fan clubs. So, you know, then we had to be very vigilant to make sure that the negotiations that followed included a very primary demand that there be alternatives for the street traders who've now lost their livelihoods. And the city took care of that. So that was, you know, an example of one situation. In Durban, there was a major, a long, long, sort of sustained effort to save a market, which the city wanted to demolish, to make a road, where, you know, to build a taxi rank and new highway traffic sort of infrastructure in time for the FIFA World Cup. And this market, it's a fruit and vegetable market, linked to the livelihoods, really, probably of 10,000 of the poorest people in Durban. I mean, it's the poorest families who've got no other source of income. So also, without alternatives being provided in any meaningful way, without the consultative process that should have taken place. So there were a lot of protests around what was going to happen to that market, what would happen to the traders, and why hadn't they been consulted. So that has gone to court. And of course, FIFA's already happened. So in a sense, we sort of feel that, you know, that was a very important element of not letting the justifications that a city hosting the games might bring to start making these beautifications in the name of progress and growth, where you are robbing the urban poor, who are often very invisible, you know, of jobs, and not necessarily providing them with alternatives either. So that was another example of what happened. In one of the towns in Rustenburg, there was a very proactive group of street traders who challenged their local municipality, because the municipality started harassing them and confiscating all their things. And you're a street vendor, you don't earn very much. When they confiscate your goods, it's really very serious. You have rights to actually be trading. So they went to a public law firm and got assistance and challenged their rights, challenged the municipality on what they were doing, confiscating their goods. And they won. And so when the English team was coming to Rustenburg and they started doing this cleaning up, and there were 300 or so street vendors in Rustenburg, and whittled down to about 10, because people were being intimidated. So they went back to the courts and they asked the court ruling be, you know, respected fully. And it was. So, you know, they were also, in a sense, reassured that they do actually have the rights to carry on earning a living. When the campaign came to a close, you know, I think the campaign also recognized that all the funds that had been generated in soccer should have been fed back into the street traders who had been moved, because by and large, what happens is that the host cities require, there's an exclusion zone. Those exclusion zones are in the stadiums and around the stadiums. And those are traditionally places where street traders have traded always at soccer matches. So there was maybe, you know, several thousands of people who actually lost their livelihoods without any compensation at all. So they are simply told that if you trade there, you're going to be arrested. And they were. So the demand is, you know, why don't you think along the lines of the Millennium Development Goals around poverty reduction? And the majority of these traders are often women, single-headed households. And, you know, I don't think FIFA perhaps had thought about that, but we're trying to introduce the idea that FIFA have a lot more concern around what happens to the urban poor, and that if they're going to take people's jobs, that they think about how to rather give people support in building their incomes rather than taking them away.
Louise Haysom, you mentioned the Millennium Development Goals. This is a United Nations project, I believe. A lot of folks in the U.S., I think, will be hearing about this for the first time. Can you talk about what these goals are?
United Nations, as I understand it, have set targets. And the Millennium Development Goals, there's several of them. I would say that people who want to go and find out about the Millennium Development Goals need to go and read about it, because it's not something I can tell you immediately, but certainly in relation to gender, you know, it relates to women's health, reproductive rights. There's one on poverty, there's one on health. And as I sit here, I must say that I would have to go and read properly again. But, you know, they really do set they're setting targets to reduce poverty, for example. In South Africa, there's a very worrying, just to give you an example, the one that comes to mind amongst, you know, all of them, and that there are a lot of different goals set for different areas of concern around global development, health, you know, around the issues that affect, the global population's well-being. And South Africa, it's child mortality. And the child mortality rates in South Africa are so bad. And, you know, life expectancy is very low, and that is because of HIV/AIDS. And when you were talking to me about the picture of South Africa, I never quite got to that, but that is also very much linked to a very difficult profile, you know. On the one hand, the economy has, you know, achieved economic growth, but we also actually have the highest population that has HIV/AIDS. If, you know, by per, it's not a percentage. It's actually, if you look at how many people are per population, we have the highest rate in the world. So the issue around Millennium Development Goals is a very important way for targeting for every country, particularly in the south and the less developed countries of the world, to see where they are and how well they've done and are doing in relation to reaching these goals. And the United Nations focuses on them. There are reports that countries have to submit. And through tracking the progress, you can see, you know, what has happened in South Africa on this particular issue. What happens when you take incomes away from the urban poor who are vulnerable to HIV/AIDS, who are single, you know, who are the breadwinners of households. So that is in a sense trying to link the Millennium Development Goals to redistribution of the profits that people never saw to a group who were actually asked to just kind of forfeit their opportunities so that FIFA could take place. But, you know, I don't see big business doing that, you know. So it's like big business will not necessarily take into consideration what the real costs are of actually holding these games. So, you know, social activism and raising awareness is really quite important. As much as one loves soccer and, you know, that's not the issue. The issue is, what is the real price that you pay? And to make sure that that the real benefits do come to everybody, not just a few international companies who are licensed by FIFA to advertise and to sell beer and so forth, which is what happens. So South African beer wasn't for sale. We were drinking Budweiser.
Sorry about that.
No, it's not very nice. I went to one match, so I can say how wonderful it was. You know, it was really incredible to be in the stadium. And the stadiums were enormously expensive. So, you know, there is some, if you look at it very, with an open mind, you know, there is some legitimacy around the kind of concern, saying, how do you end up spending these billions of rand on stadiums, which in a lot of towns and the host cities are going to sit there with a white elephant? You can't turn it into housing. You're going to put the poor in there, you know. I mean, it's tragic. I mean, we've got really, really, really huge communities of homeless people. So those are things that I think Brazil may not have to deal with. I believe that they're not building stadiums. They've got their own stadiums, as you know, they take them as they are. But there are other issues, and so wherever it goes, you know, it's not just saying, you know, FIFA should be more fair, but looking actually, what does FIFA do that it could do better, and you know what host countries can do that they could do better. It's not just about government, it's about people as well. You know, soccer's about the game, it's about how you play and playing fair. And
Yeah.
Luis Hazen, when you look back over South Africa's experience and you look forward to Brazil's, would you say it's a net positive or a net negative having the World Cup in one's country?
You know, I'm not qualified to talk about Brazil, really, because it hasn't happened yet. And I'm not sure if I can really sort of speak in a kind of, you know, like a total authority on this, but really from the perspective of seeing what happened, you know, the experiences I was saying about how the Cape Town traders lost their market. And you know, the traders in Durban lost a 100 years market had we not put up a fight. So if you don't fight and you just accept FIFA as it is, here's FIFA. FIFA's got exclusion zones. FIFA infrastructure requires that the poor just disappear and get poorer. Huge amounts of public expenditure, which economists need to, you know, make that proper assessment. Is it worth it? How many jobs involved in the stadium? And there are some benefits, of course. And for the game, and for, you know, the upgrading of the infrastructure of the country, those are the two main things that people talk about in South Africa, because there were obviously huge investments in those things, and that is a long-term investment. But you can't do it without looking at what is happening to the people who are frequently moved to yield up this beautiful, clean type of city where there are no poor people, there are no street children, the street children have disappeared and so forth. You know, there are no homeless people in our city. Meantime, people have been moved. And I mean, there were. There's records in Cape Town of a lot of people being evicted to, you know, to accommodate soccer players and so forth. So yes, you know, in absolute terms, of course there are benefits, but I think one of the things about living in a democracy, which we are in South Africa, is that you can do these things. And I think that had it been 25 years ago, I doubt any of us would have been able to do this with the same degree of confidence. Because certainly we did hold protests. There were several marches around the Durban early morning market issue, and there were also protests in Cape Town around the parade when it was earmarked by, you know, for FIFA. And in Joburg, street traders also wanted to meet with FIFA to demand they have their rights, you know, to trade. So there's also a huge need for awareness raising. People know what is FIFA. It's not a FIFA, because this was one of the slogans in the march. FIFA, you know, it's coming to town and we're protesting. It was a June the 16th march organized by Durban Social Forum, which, you know, combines a lot of different organizations of the homeless, Durban South Environmental Alliance, who have problems around the environmental degradation and racism that they've inherited, and many other groups, including the street vendors, really making the point that the expenditures on the stadium were uncalled for. They were extravagances, which you know, given the situation of the people in the city, could we really justify it? Could it be justified? And the kind of penalties that this might involve, that we actually now going to be poorer. So that march was, you know, attended by a lot of people. So there's been certainly an attempt to draw attention to these issues. It's not as if these things have been happening in a kind of a vacuum.
Luis Hey, Sam, I wanted to go back to the founding of StreetNet, or Street Network, StreetNet being short for Street Network International, as a type of trade union for street vendors. It's quite a unique idea. I think most street vendors, and I think here in D.C. as well, are probably out kind of on their own. And it seems like an important idea to form some solidarity to protect these folks that are, it seems quite vulnerable when you think about it.
I just have to preface what I meant to say. You know, I no longer work for StreetNet, but I don't think there's any harm in me sharing with you. You know, I did the internet, under the website for the organization. So I need to just say, look, I'm not really qualified as a spokesperson, but I can certainly share with you, you know, what I do know. StreetNet formed in 2000 because of the 2000 as an association, and the people who were tasked with forming the organization held workshops in Latin America, Asia, and Africa to lay the groundwork for an organization that would seek to represent street vendors' interests internationally, because they have no profile, they're largely invisible, they have nobody really representing their rights. And as in what you know, we would understand as informal economy workers, they're not formal workers, and they're also own account workers, is to try to build some sort of rights into the work that is done by street vendors, because they are very vulnerable to any number of exploitations and abuses, largely by, you know, national governments, local governments. So it's the idea that people are actually working in public space. They're informal economy workers, which means they don't have an employer. And there are street vendors all over the world, in most of the big cities of the world, who are not able to negotiate or represent themselves to decide what rights they might have in relation to how they work. Because of that, there's a the problem of income insecurity, livelihood insecurity. There is no health security, and there is no, you know, there's no equivalent social security net that other workers who work in the informal economy, at least the formal economy, you know, the formal economy workers will have a pension, you know, a medical aid, and you know, if you're a woman, you would have maternity benefits and so forth. So StreetNet launched in 2002 to start trying to do this work. It now, in 2010, it has around 35 affiliates in about 30 countries. In Latin America and in Asia, and in Africa primarily. It also has an affiliate in New York City. It's called the Street Vendor Project. And it's a very interesting organization, but it's the only North American organization. And they are just starting actually to work with organizations in other cities. I think they had a meeting recently in Latin America that we carried in our newsletter, StreetNet newsletter, you know, on this meeting to try to look at how street vendors in other cities might work together. And they also had a great thing, you know, they've got this Vendy's Award. The Vendy's Award is awards for street vendors selling, you know, food vendors, who does the best. And so the street vendors in America are very alive, you know, they probably are this. Probably a lot of organizations and a lot of issues that like in every other country, certainly Latin America, very elaborate laws around street vending that have evolved in some countries, particularly I think in Africa, where I'm a little bit more familiar with the law. Some of the laws go back to colonialism and they've never been updated. You know, they are... very outmoded regulations governing street vending. But really, yeah. I think that's all I can really say.
I'm always amazed with street vendors, that's the amount of hours that, like in D.C., they stand at a booth, you know, maybe sit in the heat, in the cold. And the business, if they're selling, you know, pretzels or whatever, the business that is next door to them, be it a big restaurant, they have a lot of clout. But the street vendor, his situation is very perilous. And I don't know, do you have any further comment on the street vendors?
I think street vendors often find themselves in precarious situations because they do have this situation where the cops are going to chase them, or it's the retailer or the restaurant who regards them in some way trespassing on their doorstep. So that whole question relates to the use of public space as working space for the urban poor who have no other jobs, can't find employment. And in the Indian economy, for example, where there are a lot of street vendors, and street vendors are recognized as playing a part in the development of the economy. Informal economy workers, 90% of you know, the total workforce, which is to give you some sense that not all economies are the same. And what do people do when they don't have work? Not everybody floods into the streets. Some of them might, you know, be working in the countryside and form cooperatives. But people form markets. There's street trade. Some of them are people who are working in their homes as garment workers. And, you know, like there is a street net, there's also what's it called? Home Net. It's called Home Workers, you know, it's a Home Workers International organization. So the idea that people are precarious is a very important recognition that the vulnerability needs to be regulated so that people can actually earn an income. So that really is part of what the organization is trying to do, is develop ways in which street vendors organizations can represent themselves, have voice, so that people are not making decisions for them. The fact that you outside somebody's shop may need to be regulated. If you go and sit in front of a robot, you may need to be regulated. But those are issues that affect every sector. It shouldn't mean that you can be shifted from pillar to post, have all your stuff, you know, confiscated by a cop who has no need to be accountable to you or to anybody else. And I mean, a country like Argentina, for example, they used to arrest street vendors and imprison them. So it's you know, different laws persist and need to be challenged. And in Argentina, the Argentinian organization, which is Civara, I think with other trade union groups, successfully challenged the law, and they've introduced a new law, which is a just law. So street vendors are not criminalized anymore. They have the right to actually earn a living. So, you know, and for some economies like the Argentinian economy, the unemployment rate is very high as well. So you know, the other competition that I think municipalities will often raise is the thing of cars. You know, is it cars or people? And modern cities tend to say, look, cars are more important than people. So that also has to be evaluated. Are you giving more space to parking garages? You know, what is your urban planning sense of the thing? Where are the rights of the people? And what is the role that they're playing? And the extent to which that is recognized, I think, I'm sure you would agree, it's very important.
Luis Asim, I also wanted to talk about this magazine that I'm holding here called Agenda, Empowering Women for Gender Equity. You are an editor with this magazine, and this edition is called Gender and the Legal System. You talked briefly before, but maybe go into a little bit more depth about the situation with regard to gender in South Africa.
Well, I did speak a bit earlier that, you know, some of the problems we're having in South Africa have a definite gender dimension. And in fact, it's very difficult to take gender out of anything, because you should put gender in it, you know. So South Africa is a country, people think of it as race, it's also gender. And the gender dimensions that I was talking about earlier are the very, very worryingly high rate of gender violence that is occurring in the country. It's also affecting children. There's a very high rate of violence against children. And the HIV/AIDS, and that is very important, has a gender dimension, of course, because it affects women and men in different ways. Women, because of the reproductive role that they have, are vulnerable in far more important ways that relate to, you know, childbearing and mother-to-child transmission, which, you know, you might not on the face of it say it's very important. And I think that one of the big struggles in South Africa has been to say that you have to recognize the gendered dimension to HIV/AIDS. And coming out of that, one of the issues is protection for women who've been raped. And, you know, 10 years ago we were demanding, women in Parliament were demanding, you know, feminists were saying, we've got to make sure that women are protected. And also, of course, men. I mean, men who've been raped, there are also men who are raped, you know. Is a post-prophylaxis treatment, which you are automatically supposed to be able to get access to. And that didn't happen automatically. So these struggles are gender struggles. And they aren't, you know, we've made progress. I mean, I have been the consulting editor. The guest editor of this issue is a gender and paralegal activist whose name is Lillian Arts. And, you know, she does, if I can just talk about this issue, she does a lot of work in the sphere of legal rights, justice, the courts, the policing system around gender and violence. So we have published this issue, and we sent out abstracts, which we always do, inviting people to contribute articles. Because, you know, when you've got a new democracy, you have the expectation that the Constitution, which says there is gender equality, much like the American Constitution does, but in application, that doesn't work. You know, there is no real gender equality in a lot of spheres. And the reasons for that are not always clear. And it takes maybe a kind of a research project or students who can identify and recognize where these problems are arising, you know, to write about them and research them. And in this issue, you know, I would say that one of the salient points, the most worrying, the salient point that comes up is that customary law, which is a parallel law running next to the Constitution, does not give to women the same degree of equality in any way that, it, you know, one can say, look, it's equivalent to what the powers that men have at the household level. Where customary law, you know, I think has really, it's very strong in terms of determining what happens in people's, you know, contracts with marriage, death, what happens to your children in the rural communities. But because it's customary law, it's the kind of law which people aren't always, you know, talking about in the same way. But one of the worrying things at the moment is that the customary law has been rewritten, and the new law rolls back the rights of women you know, to almost to what was prior to democracy, to where there are traditional courts and women are not necessarily allowed to stand up and defend themselves and their own rights. They have to be defended by a relative. And there are other implications that because of the lack of equality, I mean, and the lack of women to represent themselves in those courts as adults, you know, the locus standi is now defined in terms of what used to pertain as customary law. And what used to pertain is certainly discriminatory, and it tends to treat, has, you know, there was a law in KwaZulu-Natal which treated women as minors. So that article is a very good article, and this, and the one I'm referring to is a research on the traditional courts and the outcome of what has happened is possibly only going to be clear. Yeah, the outcome on that really is still in process because it's gone to the Constitutional Court. Well, they've made an application to have it repealed, amended. So there are other pieces in, you know, in this journal, very, very interesting writing around rape and the policing of rape, how well it's investigated by the police. And this particular article found that the police often don't do their work at the scene of the crime, so they can't follow up. So that's really a research piece that, you know, is asking how can the police do their work better in investigating forms of gender violence, particularly rape. But not only rape, it's, you know, there are other forms of gender violence, which is assault. So that kind of research is a very feminist kind of research. And police need to be aware that, you know, women are also concerned about how effective is the law in actually ensuring that if a woman is raped, that the perpetrator is also, you know, punished, found guilty and punished, if he is guilty. But clearly, if you don't get the evidence at the site, it's a problem. So
I just want to go back to the earlier piece. If I heard you correctly, you said that a woman can't represent herself in court, but a man can. And this is, I mean, this is going to be heard at a higher level, but did I hear you right that is the case in some instances?
Yeah, I mean, that's what, that's, you know, in the past, that was a situation. And so the locus standi that affects women was changed under a law governing customary marriages and customary law. So what is happening now, women perceive as actually a rolling back of their rights by traditional leaders who have introduced this law. And the traditional leaders are men who hold an awful lot of responsibility, and they are actually making decisions about the extent of women's power. So women are very worried about that, and they're offering a challenge, because it shouldn't roll backwards, it should go forwards.
Louise Haston, we only have a couple of minutes left. You've got a plane to catch to New York.
I've got a bus to catch.
Bus to catch to New York. But I'd be remiss not to bring up race in South Africa. And so if you can talk about that, as well as I was interested to learn that your brother was, in fact, Nelson Mandela's lawyer when he was imprisoned. Can you touch on South Africa and race? You mentioned earlier also that the protests that were held around street vendors led to some victories, and that this was not something that could have been done 25 years ago. What was the apartheid government like at that time?
You've asked me about 3-4 questions in one. Can you just give me 1 or 2, and then I'll try and answer them?
You pick the 1 or 2 in these last minutes.
I think that, you know, when you look back at apartheid, you weren't able to protest, you know. If you protested, you could protest on your own. There was, you know, not allowed to. I mean, the Black Sash was one organization where women we're forced to stand 16, you know, meter, or whatever, how many meters apart. So that was the law. And if you broke that law, they came and arrested you. So you could not protest. So what we have been doing effectively is actually trying to protest and also finding some opposition from the government, saying, you know, the local government saying you can't march. But in effect, you are, largely, there's nothing that should stop you, you know. The law doesn't say you can't march. The only reason why you can't march is if you endanger the traffic or you endanger, you pose some sort of threat to the traffic. So that's, you know, that's very different. I mean, your right to freedom of expression should be guaranteed. And I think that we found that certainly there are times when you're not quite sure, but they've refused you the right because it's the middle of the FIFA World Cup, and the right to march, and, you know, by organisations has been turned down. And so that did happen. But it's certainly a lot less repressive than under apartheid.
A bit more on race, and I'm very interested in note about your brother and as Mandela's lawyer when he was imprisoned.
You know, race is linked to class. And class in South Africa is, you know, there's a very large, how can I put it? You know, in America you have a black minority. We are an African country with a very sort of small minority and shrinking minority of white people. And the other minorities are coloureds and Indians, so-called coloureds and Indians. That's how we kind of, you know, continue to live with our racial labels. But race, yes, continues to be a very important factor in South Africa's day-to-day life because affirmative action is based on turning the kind of racism of apartheid around and trying to ensure that those who were historically disadvantaged will secure jobs and will, you know, will now be able to actually benefit from the freedoms, from all the choices that exist fully in a democracy, in a non-racial democracy. Yeah. So if you're looking for something else on race, I'm very wary. I think race is a very difficult thing. I mean, you want to re-racialize, or you want to de-racialize. How does race, you know, raise its, how does it get defined now compared to what it was in apartheid? How do we see it? I think those are the things that are very interesting. But we live in South Africa and we all, you know, trying to integrate and understand each other better. And I think that's very important after so many years of segregation and serious political oppression of, you know, any opposition to that, which happened before 1994. And my brother is Finkasem, and he was indeed working for President Nelson Mandela during his term of office. There's not much I can really say about that, except, of course, it was a very exciting time. I think my brother was invited by Mandela and the Mandela administration because he had actually served three or four sets of prison, you know, terms under the apartheid detention without trial. There were no charges brought. And he was imprisoned three or four times. And he was a human rights lawyer who was working for, like a public law company, but there was three or four lawyers who were doing a particular kind of labor practice to respond to the incredible number of you know, acts of repression against people, whether it was torture, harassment, removal of a passport, even, you know, disappearances of people. Fink Hasten by that time had built quite a solid base for his practice of law under the apartheid regime, if you can put it, the regime of apartheid where this was happening. And when Mandela was released and he was elected as the president, that was a very big moment. And, you know, I think Fink always says that Nelson Mandela was one of the kindest employees he ever had. He's a very enormously thoughtful and a caring man, as you would know. But I can't really say much more than that because, you know, I don't think it's about me. But I'm enormously proud of my brother. Yeah.
Any final thoughts you want to share? Luis Haysom, I don't want you to miss your bus, but if there's any final thoughts, I'd love to hear them.
Yeah, well, I wish I could spend more time in Washington because obviously, you know, there's a lot for me to learn about America as well. But, you know, on my story, I hope that I've been clear and that people have a sense of some of the issues that one might be, you know, trying to confront in Southern Africa, particularly in South Africa. And I don't think I have anything more to say, really. Yeah.
Thanks so much.
It's a pleasure.